Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with a scholar who is quite well known as a commentator on the politics of the Middle East. He has been here on this program before, not in the flesh, but he's been here on the program by telephone a number of times. He is here visiting the campus, and we're very pleased to have him with us in the studio, Rashid Khalidi. He is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Is often interviewed on major media around the United States and around the world. He's authored many books and articles about the Middle East, and is particularly known for having written about the development of Palestinian identity and Palestinian nationalism. Just a couple of his recent books I'd like to mention: The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood, that was published last October, and also Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. That book was published in the spring of 2005, and then also Palestinian Identity, that was published in 1998. He is here to give a talk as part of the MillerCom series, a number of units on the campus sponsoring, including the program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 on the U of I campus, Rethinking the Cold War in the Middle East. And these are always open to the public, and anyone who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. Also, he will be doing a book signing this afternoon at 1 o'clock. This is at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus. So if you would like to meet him, you can do that. And certainly anyone who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana would be welcome to attend the talk. That's at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. That's on West Illinois in Urbana. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. And on here on the program as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep moving along and get in as many as possible. But, of course, callers are welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure.
I appreciate it. Two things that I thought perhaps we might talk a little bit about, and these are obviously very large subjects, worthy of at least a book, if not more. One would be about the ways that colonialism has shaped the Middle East as we know it today. And the other would be, perhaps you might say a couple of things about the Cold War, the subject that you'll be talking on this afternoon. In brief, say to start with the first, what are the most important ways in which the colonial experience has helped to create the Middle East and the kind of tensions in the Middle East that exist today?
Well, you actually talked about the two major external forces, colonialism and the Cold War, that have helped to shape the Middle East in the last century and a bit, century and a half. Colonialism obviously created many of the states in the Middle East. We would not have a Jordan or a Kuwait. We would not have many. We would not have an Israel. We would not have a Lebanon were it not for colonialism. Obviously, each of these entities developed out of something that preexisted. So there was a Lebanon in the sense of Mount Lebanon. There was a certain sense of identity. There was a Jewish people. There was a population of Kuwait. But the specific configurations, the borders, many of the characteristics of the very states that make up the Middle East today are a function of an interplay between those indigenous forces and colonialism. And in some cases, the borders are directly go back to lines put on the map by British and French statesmen 1,500 miles away, doing things for reasons that had nothing to do with the people on either side of those lines. So you look at the very straight lines that make up a very large proportion of the borders of most Middle Eastern states. These are lines drawn by people far, far away. So that's one of the examples of the impact of colonialism.
And so we get countries created because people have taken, as you say, people take out the map and they take out rulers and they start drawing lines.
Certainly the borders. In some cases, the countries.
Yeah. What that does is creates, in a sense, states that, I don't know if it's correct to say states that are artificial, but states that would not have naturally existed, probably.
Well, I mean, all borders are artificial. I would say borders that are artificial to some extent. That's not always the case. I mean, there are some places that have what I call stateness that goes back millennia. I mean, look at Egypt. There has always been an Egypt. Since there's been history, there's been an Egypt. It hasn't been a nation state. It's been an empire. It's had different rulers. It's had different configurations of its peoplehood. But there has literally always been an Egypt. As long as there's been humanity recording things, as long as there's been civilization, there's been an Egypt. And it's an example of something which is not just a culture, but also a state. The bureaucracy in Egypt, in some respects, goes right back to the pharaohs. I'm not saying the scribes who, you know, helped build the pyramids are the lineal ancestors of the people who run the massive Egyptian bureaucracy. But there's something to that continuity. On the other hand, there are other structures, and I mentioned some of them, which are much more conjunctural. I mean, the Kuwaiti state. Had British imperialism not interacted the way it did with the Ottoman state, all of that region might have been part of a different configuration. So I would say I would not talk so much about artificial states, but I certainly would talk in some cases about artificial borders.
Mm. What about the Cold War then? That must have then built on what had come before. In what way does the Cold War then contribute to the Middle East as we know it now?
Well, one of the first things that the Cold War does is that because of the competition between the United States and the Soviet Union immediately after World War II, and because of their exploitation of the anti-colonial card, it very rapidly puts an end to the colonial era, or at least it helps the anti-colonial forces all over the world, including the Middle East, to end the colonial era. So what was impossible before the Cold War for peoples in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East in terms of getting rid of foreign armies, getting rid of foreign forces, suddenly becomes much easier after World War II. And this is a function of the weakening of Britain and France in World War II and other colonial powers like Holland and so forth. But it's also a function of the support given by both the United States and the Soviet Union in different ways and for different reasons to anti-colonial movements. So that's the first enormous impact of the Cold War on the Middle East. It helps accelerate the process of decolonization.
Mm. Certainly, though, what happens after colonial rule, a particular place ends, that doesn't mean that the colonial powers are no longer interested
Precisely.
Or no longer involved in politics in that country.
Whence the term neocolonialism?
Well, in what ways then do those countries that had interests, perhaps the United States wasn't a colonial power, but certainly it has interests, countries like Britain and France particularly, continue to be involved and somehow continue to shape what happens?
They are. Whether you want to call it neocolonialism or you want to call it continuing interests, you can look at the French relationship with North African countries or its involvement in Lebanon, where it's up to its neck right now, today. France is deeply involved in the crisis in Lebanon. Or you can look at the way in which Britain continued to be involved in many of its former colonial possessions. The involvement of the United States and the Soviet Union, I think, takes on a different form. It's not certainly colonial. Though you could talk about the Soviet Empire in a certain sense within the borders of the Soviet Union. In some respects, it's colonial. But outside its borders, the Soviet Union and outside of the traditional area where the United States interfered with impunity for a century and basically dominated things in a neo-colonial fashion, the Caribbean and Central America, these two powers, I think, operated in a different fashion than the old colonial powers. As a general rule, they didn't invade and occupy. As a general rule, they did not restructure these countries from the ground up in the image that they themselves had. They tried to influence obviously these countries, and they in many cases were overweening in their attempts to do so. And there's been a very strong reaction against that, both against the Soviet Union when it was still in existence, against the way in which the Soviet Union tried to exercise influence, and also against the way the United States exercised and exercises its influence. I'm not even talking about Iraq, which I think is a different kettle of fish. Hmm. I'm talking about reactions to American influence in various countries in the Middle East or reactions to Soviet influence.
Yeah. Certainly, the countries of Europe have been involved in this region going back at least to the collapse of the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States has been certainly been interested going back, well, maybe at least to the middle part of the last century.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that whenever we talk about the politics of this region and the involvement of external powers, a lot of people say, well, you know, the bottom line to everything is oil.
Yeah.
That's what certainly drives the interest of the United States in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. And I'm sure that there are some people would be prepared to argue that if there was no oil there, that we wouldn't care.
That's not true. It's not true at all. Oil is enormously important. But the Middle East has another characteristic, which was true for millennia, and that's its strategic position. It's astride the land link between the landmass which we call three continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe. It's in the middle. It's on the borders of the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, the Black Sea, and the Mediterranean. It is extraordinarily important strategically for east-west communications, being on the southern flank of Russia, being at the conjuncture of all of these oceans and seas. So since time immemorial, since there were states, since there were empires around that region, the Middle East has been extraordinarily important strategically and still is. Before oil was discovered in the Middle East, the British, 1901, the Darcy Concession in Iran. Before that, there was an extraordinary strategic competition between all the great powers over the Middle East. And that competition only intensified as oil became more and more important in the lead-up to World War I, and especially before, during, and after World War II, when the vital necessity of oil to the war effort of Germany and Japan proved to be one of the vital choke points that enabled the Allies to win that war so relatively quickly. Everybody by the end of World War II understood the enormous importance of oil. So the Middle East was always, always important strategically. It became even more important when the vast reserves of oil there were discovered.
Mm-hmm. If, I'm not even sure if it's possible to do this, but if you look at today, at the politics of today, what's going on in the Middle East, and how the United States and Europe and perhaps countries of Asia are interested. If it was possible to take oil out of the equation, mm-hmm. maybe you actually can't, but if it was possible to take oil out of the equation, certainly from what you were saying, is all these countries would still be very interested. That strategic
right.
kind of importance you talk about is still there.
Right. I mean, look at Napoleon. There was no oil when Napoleon went to Egypt. Mm-hmm. Look at the British occupying Egypt. Look at the French taking Syria and Lebanon. Look at the British taking Iraq after World War I. All of these are examples of the perceived, and you could talk about other empires, the Romanovs, the Habsburgs, and so on and so forth, engaged in this same competition for control over this vital strategic space. The same thing is true in World War II. It's not just oil that leads Hitler to launch his ill-fated drive south towards Stalingrad. Partly he's going for the oil fields of the Caucasus. But it is also the strategic importance of the Middle East, understanding that putting himself there would put him astride the British route to India. The same thing is true of the German campaign in North Africa. Same objective, cut the Suez Canal. Obviously, oil by that point was really quite important. The Germans had very little of it. They were manufacturing synthetic oil. They understood the importance of it to their war effort, as did the Allies. But the strategic importance of the Middle East was at least as major a factor in both British, American, Soviet, and German calculations and Italian calculations in World War II. And that's just an example in an era when oil is already vitally important of the vital strategic importance of the Middle East. Nothing has really changed, I would say.
Let me introduce just very quickly again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Rashid Khalidi. He is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and has written widely and has been widely interviewed on the politics of the Middle East. He is here on the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk in the Millercom series. He'll be talking on the topic Rethinking the Cold War in the Middle East this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center. Anyone interested should feel welcome to attend. Also here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. What do you make of all that has been written, particularly since 9/11, mm-hmm. about the clash of cultures and this region as a focal point for that clash between, you know, how people set up the dichotomy east-west, mm-hmm. modern, anti-modern, fundamentalist,
right.
Progressive, you know, all those. And I suppose that some people would say in a lot of ways that's a false dichotomy
right.
all the way along.
I would myself.
Well, talk about that.
Well, I mean, you only have to go to a place like Dubai or, for that matter, Cairo to understand how false that dichotomy is. I mean, the Middle East is modern. It has important aspects of tradition and anti-modernism, obviously, as does our society. I mean, the reactionary trends in American or European society are at least as important as are other trends in our societies. The Middle East has them too. But the Middle East is and has for a very long time been profoundly modern in whatever sense you define that term. Moreover, this concept of civilizations implies impermeable boxes which have deep roots that have no connection with one another. This is fundamentally false. Islamic civilization is a hybrid civilization. Western civilization is a hybrid civilization. Islamic civilization is in some profoundly ways Western in the sense that the Greeks' philosophy, monotheism, are shared. And many, many other things, many, many other scientific values, many other things are profoundly shared, as is obscurantism, a certain kind of reading of religion. Those are shared also. Mm-hmm. So the reactionary things in Western civilization, the reactionary things, what I call reactionary, is things that look back to a imagined past. And some of the more forward-looking things in these two cultures, in some respects, go back to the same roots. The people who are the philosophical antecedents of some of the so-called fundamentalists were reading Greek philosophy and came out of it with some of the same things that you get in a Leo Strauss or a Carl Schmitt, two very quintessentially Western political philosophers. So I really think these are false dichotomies. These are not impermeable containers completely isolated from one another, which is the concept of civilization in its worst guys, and have shared roots. I mean, the Islamic civilization at its time of flourishing drew on India, drew on Persia, drew on Byzantium, drew on all of the advanced civilizations of its time. And when I say drew on them, I mean, if you look at the great monument of 7th century Islamic architecture, the Dome of the Rock, it's impossible to tell whether the artisans who worked on it were Byzantine artisans or Muslim artisans, because the art is intertwined. It is Islamic art, and it's a continuation in some ways of Byzantine art. I mean, it's the quintessential example of Islamic architecture. It's one of the most important buildings in Islamic architecture. And from the detailed work to the structure, it's impossible to tell where Byzantium ends, something that's quintessentially quote-unquote Western, and where mm-hmm. Islam begins. And that's a perfect example of the way in which these civilizations are fundamentally, thoroughly, completely intertwined. And I mean, this is not my expertise, obviously, but when you look at the 19th and the 20th centuries and you look at people who are the important thinkers, for whatever end of the political spectrum they may be in the Middle East, they're deeply influenced by Western thought. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that you start from a false premise and you can't possibly end up in the right place.
Yeah. I think about a book, actually, that was authored by the fellow whose name is on your chair, Dr. Said, the book Orientalism, and his, and he would certainly not be the only person to use a term like that to explore it, but this idea that for almost forever that people in the West, that is people in Europe, looked at everything to the East, whether that was the Middle East or right. the Far East, as being this fascinating but strange, exotic other.
Right.
Obsessed with various elements of the culture, interested in it, willing to find good things there, and yet feeling that it somehow fundamentally was different
and other.
And also the idea that it was, while it might be ancient and interesting and deep, that somehow there was always the notion of the Greco-Roman culture and everything from that point up being fundamentally
Western.
And also fundamentally superior.
Yeah.
That's sort of part of the them and us.
That it was superior, many people would agree, including many people who understand Muslim philosophy, Muslim science, all that was done for over 1,000 years, because it was totally rooted in the Greek tradition. So everybody would agree on that. The only difference is that the advocates of so-called Western civilization arrogate to themselves exclusive possession of the Greek patrimony. That book was very, very influential at the time it came out, and I think rightly so. And it is still a target of much hatred. There's an important work by an Orientalist, in fact, attacking it, and he gets big audiences. You know, people like to hear people who contradict this thesis. But I think one of the sad things when we look at this incredible explosion of publication on the Middle East since 9/11 in particular is the degree to which it's based on misperceptions that, in fact, Said's book helps us a lot to understand. The degree of ignorance about the Middle East has not decreased. I mean, there's a lot of real, genuine interest. Anybody who teaches in a university can tell you the number of courses that have had to be added, the number of language courses in particular that have had to be added in the past 5 years, a trend that just keeps growing, and that for those of us who are involved in trying to deal with it, it's quite a challenge. Mm. So there's a genuine interest; people want to know, but much of what they're getting out there, unfortunately, is not very good.
Well, I guess that just my point in raising it is that it seems that this kind of way of looking at that part of the world, the way Europeans do, and that the way Americans do, it seems that if we're still doing that, mm-hmm. we can't seem to quite get out of that mindset.
Well, I'm not sure that's entirely true. It is true to an extent. I would say that for one thing, there's a big difference between the way in which Europeans and Americans look at the region. Huh. I think Europeans, for all the flaws in the way they look at things and for all of the aspects of Orientalism that still are in parts of the European worldview, generally have a slightly closer view of the Middle East. They are closer to it. They also have huge Middle Eastern populations living among them, and that's a cause for misunderstanding. It's a cause of problems, but it also means they in some ways, this other is closer to them. We are farther away from everything in the world, pretty much, except Mexico and Canada, and that has a necessary effect. I mean, of all the peoples in the world, we probably have the worst ability to learn foreign languages. Nobody in America knows any foreign languages. In most other countries, people who have any education do learn foreign languages. It's almost a mark of pride for the American educational system that we keep our students ignorant of foreign languages. And to me, my way of thinking, it's an enormous tragedy. It has a historical explanation. We're so far away, we don't have to worry about other cultures. From the burning of Washington in 1812 until 9/11, nobody could really attack the homeland. I mean, Pearl Harbor was far away itself. So we have a different view of other cultures, partly because we're so much more isolated, so much more insulated, and because we don't know foreign languages. You can't have access, in a certain sense, if you don't know the languages of these cultures.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Oh, if you would put on the headphones, mm-hmm. that way you will hear them. And for people who are listening, certainly you're welcome to join the conversation, ask questions. Again, we just ask people to be brief so we can get in as many as possible, but callers are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a great admirer of Edward Said myself, and I agree with virtually everything he said, although this might not quite sound like it, but one of my ways of trying to understand what's happening right now is that to some extent, because so much of the Middle East, that's a wide geographic area and not very well defined, is rural, like especially, say, Afghanistan in poverty, and like the Muslim world didn't really, or Islamic world didn't really have as much of an industrial revolution mm-hmm. as the West did, and it didn't have it at the same time. If we thought of a lot of that culture as being not 600 years behind the West, you know, but a lot of the people having a mindset, asked to reduce it to this, to what extent do you think that the reaction to in the Middle East is not to economics but to the cultural thing that you might define as modernism mm-hmm. and how that juxtaposes or is in conflict with some of their more traditional beliefs?
Mm-hmm.
Could you answer that?
No. Sure. Well, I mean, you're right. You're right that the Middle East has a higher proportion of its population in rural areas than advanced countries like the United States or most European countries or Japan. But that's a trend that is actually changing. And the problem, in fact, in many respects, lies with formerly rural populations that migrate to the cities in search of opportunity. And they turn to what they understand as tradition, which in fact is quite different than whatever it was they had out in the country. It is a new form of Islam. It is a new form of tradition, and it is something that is something they cling to in response to the pressures and challenges of the big cities. And in countries like Turkey and countries like Iran and countries like Egypt, the biggest countries in the Middle East, you have this process of urbanization, which has led to a growth, among other things, in neo-tradition. It's not real tradition in the sense of it's not what they had when they were actually in the country. It's a hybrid version of it, which is a response to the problems of the cities. And these are countries that are increasingly urban. The majority of the population in Syria, Egypt, Turkey, Iran, the big countries in the Middle East, Iraq, is now urban. And so you have a whole new set of problems on top of the ones that you mentioned, which include things like there was no industrial revolution, which includes problems with education, economic problems, and so on and so forth. You now have this problem of the migration to the cities.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, is the caller still there? Did we get at your question?
Actually, I think the idea of neo-traditionalism is really a good viewpoint to take on this. So thanks. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Let me ask you just briefly to talk about something else that does often come up as an important force that drives politics in the Middle East today, and that is simple demographics, the sense that so much of the population in so many of these countries are young people.
Right.
They're people who are under maybe 25.
Right. Under 18.
If not even younger. And that the pressure that they're going to put to bear on their governments, it's been significant and undoubtedly will be more and more significant, particularly in places where people have expectations,
right.
People have an idea of what they like their future to be, and may increasingly have this sense that it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, for them to have that kind of life.
You know, this is a dual problem, because the problem of demography is directly linked to the problem of growth. Mm-hmm. And as you have faster growth and as you have a higher GDP per capita, inevitably everywhere always it has been the case that the population increases less rapidly. This is happening, for example, in Turkey. GDP per capita has almost doubled in the past 6 or 7 years because they've had 7-8% growth rates for the last 6 or 7 years. And GDP per capita has gone from 2,000 something per head to 5,000 something per head just in a matter of 6 or 7 years. The Turkish population is not growing anywhere near as fast as it used to grow because people are better off. And when they're better off, as a general rule, they tend to have fewer children. It's not always the case, but in the aggregate, that's the case. The problem here, therefore, is a problem of, in some measure, of growth, of an economic problem, of development that both increases a country's wealth rapidly and does this in a way that doesn't tear at the social fabric, because of gross inequality. So Egypt, for example, has a relatively high growth rate, not as high as Turkey's, but it is extremely unequally distributed. And it has yet to filter down in the same way that Turkey's has. It's obviously a much poorer country than Turkey. So they're linked problems.
Hmm. Well, is that part of the reason that Islamist political movements are as strong as they are?
Well, it's part of the reason. I would go back to this issue of rural migration to the cities as one of the major reasons. I would go back to the failure of secular political parties over the past 80, 90, 100 years in the Middle East. I mean, there was a hegemony of secularism in the Middle East, which is completely passed by most people who look at the Middle East. They have no idea that the Middle East was not always retrograde, Islamic, whatever. They missed 100-some-odd years of Middle Eastern history, in other words. And because of the dominance of Islamic political movements in the last 20 or 30 years, they assume that it's always been that way. But the failure of those secular political movements is another thing that I would point to. And the last is this growth demography problem. And so I think it has helped those movements.
We're just a bit past the midpoint here. Just again, quickly, our guest is Rashid Khalidi. He's professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, author of many, many articles, many books on the politics of the Middle East. He's widely interviewed on the worldwide and media. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk this afternoon, 4 o'clock, Rethinking the Cold War in the Middle East. And anyone interested should stop by. This is at the Levis Faculty Center. It's in the Millercom series. Also, he'll be doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore at 1 o'clock this afternoon, if you're interested. We have other callers. We'll go next to Gibson City. This is line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a kind of a specific question, and I just would like to get your ideas about Hamas winning in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've been there, and I am just amazed of all the peace workers, including Israeli and Arab peace workers and international people that are working for peace and justice.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't hear about these people. And I'll hang up and listen to hear what you have to say. And I just thank you for what you do.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Well, two parts to your question. The first is the people who were there. I think they play a really important role, both the Israelis and the Westerners, in making Palestinians sense that in this 40 years of occupation, they're not completely forgotten. In this country, it's almost indecent to talk about it, and nobody pays much attention to it. But for 40 years, the people of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have been under occupation. The Gaza Strip has been evacuated, but it's completely controlled from without. It's like a huge prison camp. And the presence of those people, international solidarity movement, people working for private voluntary organizations and so on, and also people, especially Israelis, who are engaged in some of these peaceful efforts to, for example, stop the confiscation of land, block the expansion of Israeli settlements and so on, give Palestinians a sense that they're not completely forgotten by the world, which understandably they might feel that they are. As far as the first part of your question about the election of Hamas, the important thing I think that has happened in the last year is that even though Hamas won the January 2006 elections, the Palestinian Legislative Council elections, and tried and failed to govern, what we now have finally arrived at after a terrible, terrible period in Palestinian history where you had an incipient civil war, is a coalition government. It's the first time that Fatah, which dominated Palestinian politics for decades, has agreed to share power with a rival. It did it unwillingly. It's very important, however. Another aspect of this coalition government that is important is that it edges Hamas towards, it hasn't fully accepted, but it edges Hamas towards accepting the PLO-Arab position, which is of a two-state solution. I myself am very skeptical whether it is any longer possible to have a two-state solution. I'm not pronouncing myself on the merits of it. I'm saying it seems to me that it may well be impossible. But it still seems to be the aspiration of most Palestinians and most Israelis. And as long as that's the case, probably that avenue should be pursued. And getting Hamas to a point where it understands and accepts that by entering into government, it has assumed certain responsibilities, I think is a major element in this coalition agreement. Obviously, the election of Hamas did not represent the endorsement by the people who voted for it of every aspect of the Hamas program. We know the core support of Hamas. It's not 35% or 45%. It's much smaller than that. It was partly a rejection of the corruption and incompetence of Fatah. It was partly a protest vote. I don't think we should be so surprised to see such a thing, given the miserable situation that the Palestinians have been in, and given that, you know, we too are capable, and every democratic society is capable of protest votes.
Well, can this coalition, this Hamas-Fatah coalition, can that actually work?
I'm not sure that it will, but it's a lot better than the alternative, which is civil war.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you say as you did that you're coming to feel that a two-state solution is not possible, what is the alternative?
The alternative is the continuation into the indefinite future of the status quo, which is
a one-state
solution. Israel occupying and treating as a helot population in the occupied territories, people who will be under military rule for another decade or two or three. Hmm. It's an intolerable situation. It will lead to constant instability in the region. But unless and until either the Israelis accept that they control the entirety of Palestine and they have to treat everybody as an equal citizen, or they have to leave the territories they occupied in 67 and completely leave them, give up control over them, that's what we're going to have. There is not a capability at this moment on the side of either the Palestinians or the Arabs to change that, unfortunately. I mean, I think that it's terrible for the Arabs. It's terrible for Israel. It's terrible for the world that there be this 40-year, in June it will be 40 years, of occupation. It's distorted everything in the region. It's not the only problem in the region. In some ways, it's not the most important problem in the region, but it's like a nagging infection that will not go away and which causes a debilitating effect on everything. Our relationship with the Middle East, obviously the position of Israel, the situation of Arab countries all around it, and most importantly, the Palestinians who are suffering under this yoke for 40 years. Every major decision in the life of every Palestinian since 1967 has been made by some Israeli captain, major, defense minister, whatever. Every important decision. Their will is not taken into account. They are a subject population. This is not visible in this country. The most extraordinary effort to cosmeticize the occupation is made. The most extraordinary effort to criticize anybody who mentions it as an anti-Semite is anti-Israeli. I think the occupation is anti-Israeli. I think anybody who supports it is driving a dagger into the heart of Israel. I think that it is one of the worst things that Israel could be doing for itself. So I think anybody who criticizes it is trying to liberate Israel from a terrible, terrible, terrible burden that it has placed on itself. And that, in fact, most Israelis don't even want. There's a whole dynamic that you'd have to explain to show why, in fact, something that is not supported by a majority of Israelis, this is to say occupation and settlement, continues to just roll on day after day, bulldozer after bulldozer, ton of cement after ton of cement, inexorably swallowing up Palestinian land, crushing Palestinians under the burden of this thing. And nobody in this country even talks about it. The bulldozers that do this destruction and building are built in Illinois. Caterpillar builds them. You can't talk about that in this country. Try and raise this as an issue and see what happens.
I have several other callers here. I promise I'm going to get to you. Let me just ask this question. How much difference would it make if Hamas, and I realize this is more difficult than it sounds, if Hamas would say, yes, we accept the existence of Israel and we're going to give up the armed struggle?
I mean, they've accepted the latter part in the sense of they have refrained from firing at anything in Israel for years, more than a year and a half. Others are doing so. In other words, Islamic Jihad and other factions have been attacking. Mm-hmm. But Hamas' argument, and I'm not necessarily subscribing to it, I'm giving it to you, is we'll recognize Israel when Israel recognizes us as part of a two-state deal. That is their position. Frankly, I don't see why the Palestinians, the subject population, the occupied population, the population whose rights and very existence is being violated hourly and daily, should capitulate at a moment when the Israelis refuse to say, yes, we will end the occupation, yes, we will remove settlements, yes, we will recognize a Palestinian state, yes, we will accept its sovereignty, and so on and so forth. I mean, why are the Palestinians expected to recognize the sovereignty and borders and so on and so forth of an Israeli state, which is sitting on their heads, stealing their land and their water, and refuses to accept the same thing for them? It would seem that this should be something reciprocal. Yeah. It would seem that this is not something that Israel is not a special country that everybody has to recognize before it recognizes in an equal fashion the rights of other peoples. And maybe Israelis think of themselves that way, but nobody else is obliged to do so, though you sometimes think the U.S. Congress wants to make us do so.
Well, this is the kind of thing that I think for an outsider is difficult to understand, and obviously this is why diplomacy is difficult.
Right.
That it seems to be a situation where each side is waiting for the other guy to go first.
Yeah, but there are elements in this that are not entirely symmetrical. If you were talking about the Arab states in Israel, yeah, they're sovereign states. Israel's a sovereign state. In a sense, there it is a matter of who goes first, and there it's a matter of proper brokering. In fact, it's the incompetence. I will talk about this in my talk this afternoon. I think that peace efforts in the Middle East have been hampered by the Cold War, because other things were more important to the superpowers than doing a proper job of ending this conflict. So on a state-to-state level, it is a matter of who goes first. As between the Palestinians and the Israelis, it's really not. The Palestinians and the Israelis are not in an equal position. They are not two peoples with sovereign states which have a border dispute. There is a people that has had a sovereign state since 1948 and which has occupied the entirety of the territory of the other people since 1967. And booted out a lot of them in 1948. That's another issue that also will have to be resolved. But there is no symmetry whatsoever, except one on top and one on the bottom. That is the only element in it that you can describe as, so in that sense, it's not a matter of who goes first. It's not, I will stop choking you if you say a certain word. That's not an element of who goes first.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Rashid Khalidi. He's the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University and is here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this afternoon. As I mentioned, we'll be doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore at 1 this afternoon. We have other callers who have been patient with me as I've asked questions. We'll get back to them. Bloomington, Indiana is next, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Professor, you mentioned how the imperial powers divided the Middle East without respecting the Arabs. Could I suggest a case where the imperial British were quite sympathetic to Arab demands, and that case was the drastic shrinking of the originally proposed boundaries of Israel, as originally proposed, and by the way, as originally promised. Israel was to include all of Palestine, including the West Bank, and in addition to all of Palestine, it was to include what is now Jordan. But the Arabs protested, and Britain drastically reduced the size of the proposed Israel. They removed Jordan. It was then called Transjordan. And they also removed much of the West Bank. And when the Palestinians tried to take Jordan, Jordan kicked them out, killed thousands of them. It was called Black September. No one complained. Jordan had a right to defend itself. But when Israel defends its very existence against the Palestinians, Israel is vilified.
Well, any comment?
Well, a couple of misconceptions there. The mandate for Palestine, to which you're referring, and which Britain got formally in 1922, and which the British decided to divide into Transjordan and Palestine, did not give anything to Israel. The mandate for Palestine said that Britain had the obligation to work towards the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people. That didn't mean that all of Palestine would become the state of Israel. It didn't mean that the Arabs had no rights there. Moreover, that mandate specifically said that Britain was free to do as it pleased with Transjordan, which it chose to do by dividing it off from the rest of the mandate for Palestine. Just to give you an analogy, France was given a mandate for Syria. It decided to divide it into Syria and Lebanon. Your claim that the division of Palestine from Transjordan is illegitimate would mean that the existence of Lebanon is illegitimate, that the divisions that the French introduced into their mandate, and which they argued they were perfectly free to do, and which some people didn't like. They also divided Syria up into a bunch of states and then recombined it into Syria. That they didn't have the right to do this under the League of Nations. In fact, obviously the mandates were sort of neo-colonial innovation, and I could talk about them more if we had more time. But in fact, the British were perfectly justified in doing it. They'd never been committed to giving the entirety of Palestine over to being a Jewish national home in any case. And the next relevant international action, which was the partition in 1947, would have created both a Jewish and an Arab state in Palestine. So, and that's the genesis of the West Bank. The West Bank has nothing to do with anything the British did. It was a result of war and a result of the 1947 partition resolution. So your history, I think you need to read a little more history. Almost nothing you said is actually correct.
Well, I want to give the caller a very quick chance for follow-up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the British concessions to the Arabs were not legitimate. I'm just saying that they were sensitive to the Arabs. And as a matter of fact, when they made those concessions to the Arabs, quite contrary to what they had promised the Jews, nobody protested. Nobody said Britain doesn't have a right to do that. Or the Jews are being misused. Nobody said that. Britain was, as you say, Britain was simply being sensitive to the Arabs.
I don't think Britain was being in the least sensitive to the Arabs. Britain was being sensitive to its own imperial requirements, which had to do with Britain controlling the whole swath of territory between the Gulf and the Mediterranean. Britain had a client in Amir Abdullah, whom it wanted to placate. This was not a result of an Arab demand. This was done in an afternoon at Cairo, at the Cairo conference, where Winston Churchill and his subordinates basically did what was in Britain's interest. I don't think there was any particular sensitivity to the Arabs. And I come back and say the British pledge to the Jews was not unlimited. You seem to assume that some Palestine expanding into, you know, the depths of Transjordan was explicitly promised by the British as a national home to the Jewish people, as a Jewish state. That was not the case. The Balfour Declaration was explicitly ambiguous. It was meant to be ambiguous, and it was extremely ambiguous, and it did not promise all of Palestine as a national home or as a state for the Jews.
Well, was there some sort of idea that there would, though, be a state for the Jews and then some other kind of...
Yes. There was the Zionist idea, which was that there would be a state for the Jews. And in the back of the minds of many British statesmen, as they privately admitted, they assumed that once demography, immigration, and so on and so forth led to a Jewish majority, that the Jews would be able to take over. But they never dared to say that because it would have caused the reaction of, among other things, the Arabs, who would have said, whoa, you're bringing in a tiny minority, or you're expanding a tiny minority in order to take over a country that has a 90% Arab population, and which, according to the Covenant of the League of Nations, is a provisionally independent state. On what basis are you doing this? So the British, even if that was their unspoken intention, could never say it explicitly, and never did. In 1939, when they issued the white paper, the British government betrayed a bunch of its commitments to Zionism and said, correctly, in fact, we never promised a Jewish state, and we're very sorry about that. And technically, that was correct.
We just have about 5 or 6 minutes left. I want to go on again to get some other callers here. We have two. Next is in Champaign, and this would be line 3.
Yes, it's extremely interesting to hear you coming to campus and hear you on the radio. I'm just curious about your view of empire and blowback on the one hand, mm-hmm. and what I refer to as ethno-nationalism on the other. The issue of, for example, Iraq, but also of the Bush administration, in particular vis-a-vis Iraq, but also Israel, and of course Israel's actions vis-a-vis Lebanon recently. And, of course, the lack of attention to the Palestinian problem, or ignoring it intentionally on the part of the administration. I'm curious on the one hand, what kind of blowback there may be in the future over the intervention in Iraq, the ignoring of Palestine in more general terms, the building potentially of military bases in Iraq, which I think is going to be done, but I haven't heard anything recently. I think they're quite secretive about that. But the military aspect of this, which you say is more important than oil, the intervention in the Middle East. And secondly, in terms of ethno-nationalism,
I don't know how much time we're going to have, so you already asked about eight or nine questions, so we have 2.5 minutes.
Yes, we better just let the...
Why don't you let me just go with what you've already given?
What you've done. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't say that strategy and bases were more important than oil. I just said that oil is not everything. They're both important. And in the case of Iraq, they are both important. I think you ought to look at the four major bases that we have created in Iraq. Huge, I mean cities really, which we've created in Iraq, and the extent to which these are intended to be temporary or permanent. And secondly, the atrocious oil law written in English in Washington and forced down, and which they're trying to force down the throats of the Iraqi parliament, which would give control of Iraqi oil production and a bunch of other things over to the major oil corporations. These are things that will lead to blowback. If not blowback, they'll lead to a strong negative reaction. The Iraqis fought the British for decades to prevent them from keeping bases in Iraq. They will fight us for decades to prevent us from keeping bases in Iraq. They and the Iranians and other peoples in the Middle East struggled for decades to get out from under unequal oil agreements. This grossly unequal oil agreement, if it's oil law, if it's passed, will lead to the same kind of anger and resentment. So there will, I'm afraid, in the case of Iraq, be, if only for these two reasons, and there are other reasons. We don't know how many Iraqis have been killed, but all of this is held to our account by most Iraqis, 80-odd percent of which want to see us gone, according to the latest polls. To the extent to which we resist that will of the Iraqi people, we're going to create resentment. And whether you call it blowback or whether you call it something else, we are sowing the seeds of future problems with this region by our occupation of Iraq. Obviously, by our behavior vis-a-vis Palestine, we're also creating resentment. So on both counts, we're creating problems for ourselves.
All right. Possible quick follow-up here, caller?
Thank you very much. One other thing I was just curious about is, I know Noam Chomsky, I think, was suggesting that he said at one point he originally liked the idea of there being a single Israel in which you had a true democracy, in other words, in which mm-hmm. Palestinians' rights were respected and so on. And one of my concerns is, of course, I mean, how can one have an ethnically defined state? Japan is an example of a country that veers in that direction, for example, that I study. How can one really have a democracy when you, the state is defined in specific cultural ethnic terms, no wonder we end up with a situation like this. And my fear is, of course, that you might get a two-state solution, but one in which both states are completely ethnically defined and mm-hmm. not very democratic in the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Israel, for its citizens, is democratic. And amazingly, the Palestinians have managed to hold several perfectly clean elections. So, I mean, if you ever were to get a two-state solution, about which, as I've said, I am skeptical, there might be some hope for those states being democratic. The question is, would the Palestinian state be viable? And another question would be, how do you get from where you are today, where there is an inexorable process of incorporation of the West Bank into Israel, the land at least of it, into Israel, How do you get from where you are today to a two-state solution? And as far as Noam Chomsky's idea, he's not the only one to have this. The idea of a single state in which you'd have two peoples or two ethnicities is one that many, many thinkers have come forward with. It faces one obstacle, which is that it would seem that majorities of both Palestinians and Israelis at this stage want their own state. It faces another obstacle, which is that Israel determines outcomes in this part of the world. As far as Palestine is concerned, it is completely subjugated to, occupied by Israel. The Israeli state doesn't seem to be inclined either to give up the occupied territories or to move away from a situation where it's self-defined as a Jewish state for one of the two ethnicities in it. There are 1.2 million Palestinian Israeli citizens, that is to say, Israeli citizens of Palestinian ethnicity or origin. And by the very definition of the state as a Jewish state, given that they're not Jewish, they and other non-Jews are, in a sense, second-class citizens. So that's one problem which you'd have to deal with. And the other, of course, is how do you get from the situation of occupation to either a two-state or any equitable, agreed one-state solution? I don't see an easy path to that.
I think at this point we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of our time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Rashid Khalady, he'll be talking on the topic Rethinking the Cold War in the Middle East. This is a talk in the Millercom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. All of these programs always free and open to the public. Also, he'll be doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus at 1 today. And certainly, if you're interested in reading some of his work, you might look at a couple of his recent books, including The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood, that was published last October, and then Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East. That book was published in the spring of 2005. Rashid Khalady is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Thank you very much.
A pleasure. Thank you.